All right. Well, we're very lucky to have as our guest today, Matt Ho. Matt is a member of the advisory boards of Exposed Facts, Veterans for Peace, and World Beyond War, as an associate member of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. In 2009, he resigned his position with the State Department in Afghanistan in protest of the escalation of the Afghan war by the Obama administration. He previously had been in Iraq with the State Department team, as well as with the U.S. Marines. He is a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. Thanks, Matt. I'm sure you're tired of hearing that bio with all the appearances you've been doing recently, but thanks so much for being here. And the first thing I want to ask you, so for our listeners to kind of get some background is, you know, would you mind first expanding on your own background and professional experiences briefly, and sort of specifically discuss your intellectual journey and how you became an activist and a member of Veterans for Peace, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me join you all. I graduated college in 1995, and I worked for a couple of years in finance before I joined the Marine Corps in January of 1998, so almost 20 years ago now. I went to officer candidate school. I became a combat engineer officer, was stationed in Okinawa, Japan for almost 3 years, and ended up working for the Secretary of the Navy directly in the Pentagon in 2002. That Forrest Gump situation, because that's how I kind of ended up there in a Forrest Gump manner, kind of got me into positions that for a person my age and experience level, you don't really get to. So I got to be a very junior person at some very senior levels, and ended up being on a State Department team in Iraq for a year, then had command of a company of Marines in Iraq, as well as working over at the State Department, and then also too with the Department of Defense before getting a direct appointment into the Foreign Service. Again, because of people I knew and kind of Forrest Gumping myself into that situation, and then resigned from that position in 2009 while I was in Afghanistan, because I wasn't going to go along with the escalation of that war after being part of everything else previously. You know, since then, I've been working in opposition to the wars, in opposition to what I've come to see and believe as, you know, these wars to preserve American empire, these wars to preserve American American conquests that we, as a country, either took through force and violence, or fell into our laps following the Second World War. But so I've been now actively since 2009 working for issues of peace and social justice. Really had the opportunity to follow my conscience. And also follow what I believe to be an intellectually honest path, that's where I find myself today.
That's great. I think you've got kindred spirits here with Chris and I. And
yeah, absolutely.
It's extraordinarily difficult to express yourself intellectually in an honest manner, especially within some of these large organizations that we're in. And today, you know, later on the pod, we're going to be talking about the all volunteer force and the end of conscription. And, you know, some of the things you were mentioning made me think about how different movements like the peace movement might be if people still had skin in the game, if individual citizens might still have to serve. So, you know, you're a volunteer, I'm a volunteer, Chris was as well. But it's really interesting to see how you've made the transition to the peace and social justice movement when so many of our citizens are apathetic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of it, I think for in Danny, you know, I believe it might be in your case as well, you know, with and probably with Chris's too, you know, you join the military for a number of reasons. I mean, I don't think anyone joins for one simple reason. You know, a lot of people join, of course, because of the economics of it, you know, to get out of whatever their situation is. But I think for a lot of us also to join for reasons, because certainly for me, it was because I was one of the main reasons I was bored. I was working in finance, and it was just, I just couldn't imagine having the remainder of my life being about spreadsheets and making sure the board of directors was happy with the current quarter's numbers. I just couldn't imagine that. And so you join because you want to be part of something bigger and you want to have maybe some adventure, you want to have risk in your life or do something serious. But I think also, too, a lot of us do join because we feel that we want to be of service. We want to help others. We want to make the world a better place. And we have this, it's mistaken or it's naive or it's not fully constructed, our understanding. But we join the military because we think that's a way to be of service. That's the way to help others. That's a way to fight for liberty or freedom. And what you find as you're taking part in these wars is that you're not the one who's changed. You're not the one who has come to have this revelatory experience. What the revelatory experience is then is not that you're on the right side, it's that you're on the wrong side. Is that you still have those values in you. You still want to help. You still want to do good. You still want to help people, have a better life. But what you've come to realize is that your military, your country, is oppressing others, is causing this violence, by its presence is fueling this insurgency. And so I really do believe that I didn't change over these last many years. It's just that I've become truer to my values and truer to my conscience, truer to my own sense of morality, and truer to what I believe I want to do with my life. So I think that's something that people need to understand, is that you don't really change as much as you become stronger or bolder, or I think maybe in my case, just so sick of what you're taking part in, you can't do it any longer. And then you end up finding a way to actually express yourself and you follow that.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like your point about whether it's you that changes or the institution, or maybe the revelatory moment is realizing that you aren't necessarily on the right side. And I've been writing about that recently. And I think it's really an interesting point and something we all have to kind of do after 1, 2, 3, or even nearly a career in the service. Chris, I'll turn it over to you. I know you've got a question.
I guess I would ask you about whether you had any success in picking out the good guys. It seemed to me when I was in the service that finding people who chose intellect and logic over other values was pretty difficult. And so, in coming out of Afghanistan, of seeing this awful war, what have been the things you felt has gotten the most word out about it?
To your first point about not seeing others with that type of intellectual honesty or that moral honesty, you do. You one of my clearest points when I finally left the Marine Corps for good in 2008, and then I ended up going into the Foreign Service. I couldn't really uncommit from that life, uncommit from that career. Is that like I didn't see any colonels or generals that I wanted to become. There weren't these people who, at that point, I was about to be promoted to major. If I had been in the Marine Corps for a month longer, I would have been promoted. You don't see. And I remember as a lieutenant and as a junior captain, seeing some majors get out at the 12-year mark, 13-year mark, and thinking, wow, that's really gutsy or in some cases really foolish. But looking back, the two of them in particular, I think about who did that, it really made a difference to me because I saw that there was a path forward. There was a way to go and follow what you believe to be the correct thing to do, as opposed to sacrificing all the time you've already put in or giving the institution one more chance, or that when you get to be a colonel or a general, you can make a difference, you can change things. I saw that these guys, took that step. And that was a really important thing for me to see, to give me the courage to do it as well. And to your second point about, getting the word out and having people understand, what I think I've seen it work best is when it comes through, you know, of course, testimonies and things from guys who served. But I think that the best manner in all of this is the more creative, the better. Use of fiction, or the use, whether it be film or novels, I think is the best form to get people understanding. You always hear that, at least growing up and studying literature and everything, always kind of understood that fiction paints a better picture of truth a lot of times than the truth actually
Absolutely.
Does. Right? You know, I mean, so I think it's in that case through various films or various movie or various books, and they don't have to be specifically about the wars. They can be science fiction. A friend of mine had had really great experience using the film Avatar back in 2010 or whenever that came out. Because at the end, everyone is cheering because the mercenaries are leaving the planet. Mm-hmm. And he's able to make that connection to people who watch the film of, okay, well, how does this relate then to Iraq and Afghanistan?
Okay.
How does this, you know, right? As well as, too, then the stronger, you know, I've always said that the two greatest works, the two things that I have felt have been the most honest portrayals of war have been, the novel Catch 22 and, of course, the film MASH. And also the novel MASH that the film was based upon is also very, very powerful. But those two works I always felt paint the picture of war the best through satire and absurdity, because there is such a heavy dose of both of those things throughout war. Right? I mean, there's both such a heavy dose of that. And, there's a terrific, I'll paraphrase it because I won't be able to quote it verbatim, but there's a terrific line uttered by Socrates about how the tragic and the comic are as inseparable as light and shade, that you can't have one without the other, right? And that those they're tied together. And I think that's so true. I mean, and so I think that's the best way of getting the message across that I've found, because so many times when people are just preaching at people or lecturing at people, it gets taken in such a heavy-handed manner, or it can be dismissed as that's just one guy's opinion. Not to negate the value of people like us speaking about our experiences. And certainly one of the organizations I do so much work with, Veterans for Peace, that's the reason for Veterans for Peace, is to educate the public about the true costs and realities of war. But yeah, that's what I've found is the best manner is through creative
means.
It's
funny, as a major who's got 12 years of service and about ready to leave, I can't help but wonder what I'm either brilliant or mad. It's hard to say. So that jumped out at me when you were talking. And, you know, I'm going to kind of pivot us back to Afghanistan for a second. But, you know, I just started reading this book called America's Longest War, or America's New Longest War. And it's by this Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel O'Connell. And one of the things that really strikes me about it is he comes to these conclusions about the futility of the war. But the book is written in 2017 and you resigned in 2009, you know. And so the shock for me is, you know, it's 8 years later that this Lieutenant Colonel is writing the book, and I admire his work so far, but it's also sad that that's how much longer the war goes on before, you know, for example, another voice speaks out. So could you explain to the listeners, you know, why it is that you took the courageous step to resign? What was it that you found so disturbing about then President Obama's war policy?
Oh, gosh. You know, I mean, for me, it was my third time at war. I've been twice to Iraq before and had struggled with issues from the war already at that point. I was already suicidal, was already, leaning on alcohol as my medication. You know, when I got to Afghanistan, though, so much of that went away. And I was living a life that was best described by one veteran I heard when I chose to go back to Afghanistan, as like, I could either die here in the U.S. or I can die back overseas. Like, that's where my mindset was. I was so sick from the war, so sick from taking part in all of it. But at that point, though, I also had a career. I also was well regarded. I had a lot of success. I was I had friends in various positions at the Department of Defense and at the State Department who I had worked for, who were senior people. So I was able to get this appointment into the Foreign Service and get a position on a PRT, a Provincial Reconstruction Team over there. The other person who at the same time got the same kind of position was a woman who had been a staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So it was certainly a closed process to do these kinds of things. She had also worked as like Bill Richardson's foreign policy advisor. But I think I also believe too that coming off of this, again, most of this was occurring in 2008, as I was going, you know, accepting this position and my thought processes. At this point, we were seeing the value of what had occurred in Iraq in terms of our engaging in the political process with the Sunnis. And I had been there in 2006, 2007, as well as 2004 and 2005, all in Sunni areas, first up in Salah Din, up in the Tigris River Valley, and then the second time in Anbar in the Euphrates River Valley. And seeing the disassociation of the Sunnis and from the political process in Iraq, their building of their grievances, why they supported the insurgency, why that was a better deal for them, and then dismantling of that, and the political process that got them to divorce themselves from al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was such a tiny percentage of the insurgency anyway. I mean, as you guys know, the bulk of the Sunni insurgency was based on nationalist, you know, reasons and grievances of being occupied, you know, as well as some of the more senior people grievances of being usurped. But, you know, seeing that and then seeing them brought back into the political process, being brought back into the spoils of our presence, if you will, and receiving the money for our presence and giving them a reason to speak with and work with the Shia as well, too, is basically giving them back their territory and turning that territory, the Sunni territory, back over to forces led by Sunnis. You know, and I thought that was going to be, and at that point in 2008, that process was working, right? And that works for a while, for a couple of years, a few years, as we know, until it doesn't work anymore. And the Maliki government, not to get into a rant about this, the Maliki government, you know, starts to push the Sunnis back away. But anyway, at that point, 2008, you see stuff from General Petraeus, who has taken over Central Command, as that is going to be the path forward. This is going to be, I believe President Obama or Senator Obama at the time, he speaks about winning the good war in Afghanistan, but he talks about only sending two brigades of soldiers to Afghanistan. He doesn't talk about sending 70,000 troops plus an extra 40,000 NATO troops plus another 100,000 contractors. He talks about two brigades. And I believe that that's going to be the process. But, you know, fairly quickly, though, right away he sends 30,000 troops, and then there's more troops being sent, and of course the final escalation of 30,000 troops in the late fall of 2009. But you could see, for me, getting there and seeing that this Democratic administration was no different than a Republican administration, that the purposes were varied and multiple in terms of why we were escalating the war. And none of them were good reasons, and all of them were going to be bound to failure. There are political reasons. You know, we got to have this president, this Democratic president, look as if and be a better commander in chief than the Republican president. This is a chance for us to have a president who has won a war going into his reelection. Elizabeth Rubin the New York Times, from the New York Times Magazine, writes about this. Spending time with Bob Gates. Yeah, I saw it as well too. The Pentagon wanted a victory. This was a chance to make up for Iraq. This was a chance to show that the Army could do something right. Up until as well too, the General McChrystal comes over with his cadre of hand-picked advisors. Most of them are not active duty military or in the CIA or State Department. Most of them are working for think tanks that are funded by defense corporations. And you're reading this, particularly this one tract that came out of the Center for New American Security called Triage about what should be done in Afghanistan. And it is basically making the case for escalation on this romantic vision of counterinsurgency, on this orientalism of how if we come and just give these native people things that they would that they need, like roads, and if we educate them through schools, that they will disassociate themselves from all their previous ways and join our side. Just basically shoehorning Afghanistan into this model to support, again, their own romantic visions of war, these romantic visions of counterinsurgency, these wannabe Kiplings, basically. And so saw that over and over again, as to then the same issues of and in the years after, particularly the first year or two after I resigned and I'd be asked about Afghanistan, I'd often get asked, what's the similarities and differences between Iraq and Afghanistan? And for a while, I fell into that trap of saying, of describing the differences. Well, you know, one's, you know, exactly, just describing the demographic differences, the terrain differences, the cultural and modern history differences, as well as the similarities. And it took me a little time to really realize what I knew to be true. None of that mattered, because the only thing that mattered was the presence of the American military, and the outcome was going to be the same. And the fact that we were trying to leverage one part of society against another, that we are trying to pick winners and losers in a foreign country, and the results were going to be the same. The results were going to be an increase in support for the insurgency. Every place we put our kids with their rifles and their vehicles, people were going to end up fighting against them. It was just a simple aspect of occupation was driving the insurgency, as well as how corrupt the government in Kabul was, how that was composed of the same warlords and drug barons and war criminals that the Taliban had been fighting against, that led so many people, particularly in the Pashtun areas, to support the Taliban. And that's why we are seeing the support again. It goes through that until I finally can't do it anymore. Finally, I can't support the lies of it all. Find myself understanding that there's nothing I can do except save myself at this point. I can't certainly go home and tell a mother her son died for a good reason in Afghanistan. I can't take seeing the dead Afghans anymore. And so I find the courage because of a note my father wrote me, to quit. And so I did. And when I quit, I really meant to quit. I really meant to just be done with it all, be done with war. No intentions of striking out and fighting against the war, American Empire, or anything like that. Those thoughts were not even a remote spark thought in my head until after I've been home for a couple weeks. And I end up becoming very frustrated by what I'm seeing and hearing about the debate about the war through our media, particularly too, since so many people that I spoke with before I departed, agreed with my assessment on the war, both military officers and civilian officials. And then to see none of that being reflected in the debate on the war was upsetting to me. And so, yeah, I end up speaking to the Washington Post. And here we are, 8 years later, still talking about it.
Really, so much what you said. First of all, it is courageous to do what you've done. And I think you've probably heard that a lot, but it is very difficult to walk away from a career you've been successful at and step into the abyss and the unknown. And you're to be applauded for that, because you mentioned how a lot of people that you served with agreed with you. Most of those people probably went on to a career, a comfortable career within the military or the foreign service. It's easier to do that. That's the easier path of least resistance. The next thing go ahead, please.
I was going to say, you do get the golden handcuffs a lot too. I was a political officer in a province, in Zabul province in southeast Afghanistan. And when I wrote my letter, it went around throughout the whole embassy, of course. And my counterparts in all the other Pashtun provinces where the violence was significant and really bad, you know. And so when my counterparts in Helmand and Kandahar, up in Kunar and Nangarhar and Nuristan, you know, Uruzgan. You know, I remember at least six of them speaking to me before I left and saying, "Hey, I completely agree with you." You know, I've got the Ambassador Eikenberry agreeing with me, Ambassador Holbrooke agreeing with me. The deputy ambassador at the embassy says to me, you know, "I've got military age children and I would not want them to serve in this war." You know, I mean, so you're having that type of view come, and that's just from the State Department people that I spoke with in the week or two before I left Afghanistan, then let alone, but people have, you know, a different, some people, you know, are able to walk away from it because they know they'll never be involved with it again. You know, particularly that's a State Department case. You know, you do your one tour there and you're done. You don't have to go back again. They'll get some other people to go. In the military, it's different, though. I think with the military, you know you're end up going to go back. You're going to end up going back potentially or probably, depending upon your MOS and your rank. But you've got a wife and you've got kids, or you're also committed to your troops. You know, you're committed to your men and your women, and so you're able to focus down and look at that responsibility, as opposed to looking at the bigger picture or having to listen to your conscience. And certainly I know that was my case when I went to Iraq my second time. I went there understanding the war to be unjust, the war to be basically illegal, that we are making things much worse. But I could focus on the 152 Marines and sailors that were under my command and only focus on them and see that as my responsibility to try and bring as many home alive and in as many pieces as I could. But as a in my role over there as a political officer, yeah, I didn't have any of that. I was free to quit. I was also a single guy, so I was able just to throw it all away and walk away and not care about the consequences because I was so sick of it. It's true when all the cliches about striking out on paths and putting a foot forward and, you know, you never know what's going to happen. All that stuff is true. But I also know that my conscience has been clean for the last number of years because of it, which is, really important.
Look at the names that are running Afghan policy again in the Trump administration. And we're seeing H.R. McMaster, who used to run the anti-corruption efforts up at ISAF, and then General Mattis, who of course served in Afghanistan, and General Kelly. So staying on Afghanistan for one more moment, you know, as a follow-on, how do you analyze the current administration's policy there to the extent that they have one, and what are the prospects for stability in the region or for Afghanistan as a whole, in your view?
I actually think that this administration has a more coherent policy, not one that I agree with. Let's get that clear first. What I'm going to say is I don't agree with it, but my analysis is that they actually have a structured and coherent policy in an entire war campaign, as opposed to individual efforts throughout the Muslim world that the consequences are the same. The killing is the same. The ruinous results of our warfare are the same. But I do see now within this administration, under Mattis and McMaster and Kelly, a coherence among the war policy throughout the Muslim world, in the greater Middle East, if you include Afghanistan, if you want to go that far east. As a policy being of one of that, look, we're no longer going to try and win in the sense of coming to a political resolution, coming to a negotiated end to the conflict, that warfare is I really do believe that, particularly Mattis and Kelly, I understand them better than I understand McMaster, but warfare is a constant state of mankind, that we are in a historical struggle of civilization versus barbarians. And I think if you look at Mattis and Kelly's public statements for over a decade now, you see that very clearly, that we are, and that they are modern day legionnaires who have a responsibility for protecting the empire, for protecting the republic. And that in these, what you would call, if you want to use the Roman analogy, the borderlands or border areas, that in these areas, we have to fight and that we have to mow the grass. That constantly, there's going to be constant combat there, constant fighting, because that's the nature of the people there, and that there's no use trying to find a solution because there is none. And that efforts to hold elections, efforts to do economic development, efforts to do reconciliation are ultimately wasted. And that's what they can point to and say under the Bush and Obama administrations, all these things were tried and they didn't work. It's interesting because how quickly Mattis, whose name was also on the cover of the counterinsurgency manual that Petraeus gets credit for, but Mattis was that co-author, how quickly he's able to walk away from all that and disavow it. But so I think what you're seeing in this campaign that spreads across six of the nations that we're bombing nearly every day or have troops engaged in combat in, with the exclusion of Pakistan. Pakistan doesn't fall into this. Is this policy that we are just going to have basically free fire zones. We're going to use massive firepower through artillery and airstrikes, and we're going to use commandos, highly trained and highly specialized forces. I think we hear the term commando and we think of our guys in Delta or guys in SEAL teams, but I think you have to broaden that to have more of a view of commandos being battalions of troops who are very loyal, very capable, well trained, who can fight well, and then you have these masses of militia fighters as well. But we're going to use our proxy forces, allied governments, or say in Syria, the Kurdish forces, to control these areas. The Saudis and the UAE in Yemen, various groups in Libya, the government forces or the Kenyans or the Ugandans in Somalia, and that we're just going to use massive force to control these populations that will not submit to the will of our policy and our proxies. And I think you've seen that unification of this policy across the Middle East, including Afghanistan. And that's why I say this administration has a coherent war policy in the sense of where they're going forward. And I think you can see that best rolled out through with the way the Iraqis, and this plays upon on what was being done at the tail end of the Obama administration, of course. But you see that especially, I think, through the Iraqi campaigns in the Euphrates and Tigris River valleys, where cities were just leveled, the people were punished, and basically subjugation is the principal desired effect. Seen again in Yemen with how the Saudis and UAE are operating. And I think it's what you'll see in Afghanistan going forward, particularly since those troops, people talk about, well, what can only 4,000 troops do? Well, it's the nature of what the troops will be training, as well as additional NATO forces, helping to teach how to call in for airstrikes, how to call in artillery, as well as providing more artillery, more gun tubes, as well as providing more airstrikes. And then using these commandos, whether they be actual guys who can come into the village middle of night and terrorize a population, akin to what, say, the Phoenix program did in the Vietnam War, the death squads did either in Central America or in Baghdad, or commandos in a looser sense who can actually fight at a company level or a battalion level somewhat well. As we saw, I think the Iraqi Special Police Forces and Ministry of Interior Forces do in Mosul or in other Iraqi cities. So I think that's, that is what I see as their policy moving forward. And this allows them to use other resources around the world, but commits the United States to a policy of military purposes for military ends only, which is a really dangerous thing. People were concerned about having all these generals in the White House, basically. And this is what you get when you have all these generals in the White House. You have a military policy that's based really just on military goals.
And which totally misses the ultimately political nature of war. But I think it's really interesting what you're saying about the differences between...
Yeah, well, I mean... And to pop onto that political point, it's not just the political nature of war, it's the political calculus that comes from having civilians or politicians in control of the military. Is they have to view the use of American power through ultimately what that's going to do to their chances of re-election or their popularity or approval ratings. There's no political control on these policies. And that allows anything to occur. When there's political control over the policies, the politicians the civilians, as we call them, or the politicians, will necessarily hold back in some regards, or will, I mean, now it could, of course, be dangerous, and they could become very populist, and of course, agree to the bloodlust of voters, maybe. But for the most part, I think what we see in many calculations by politicians is a more conservative approach, or how will this affect my chances of re-election, or how's it going to look if there are dead kids on television, which is something we never see anyway. But I really do think this complete control of the policy by the military is absolutely a very, very dangerous
thing. And I wonder if we even realize the damage to the Republic, or if it'll take a decade or two to realize what's been done. I hear that some of the results are down the road.
Yeah, you know, whether or not, and what will the next administration do, whether it be Democrat or Republican, if Trump doesn't win? I think I'm actually an outlier of a guy who thinks that Trump will win re-election. I actually do think he will, but that's a whole different podcast episode, I guess. But, you know, what will the next administration, if, say, it's a Democratic administration, will they keep up the same control of policy, this uber militarized foreign policy? And we had, as you guys know, we had a militarized foreign policy before Trump. I mean, we had President Obama, came into office with two wars and he left with seven. You know, he spent more money on the military than any other president. You go back to FDR to find a president who spent more money on the military than President Obama did. So we can't kid ourselves into thinking that this is about Trump. But what becomes of this, and what is the point that the American public recoils from it? I don't really know, particularly as one of the genius or brilliant things about this, similar to, I think, what you want to talk about with conscription, is it takes the skin out of the game for so many Americans even further. So by utilizing not just drones and manned airstrikes in areas where there's no threat of our aircraft getting shot down, but utilizing proxy forces, the American public is completely disengaged. And I think the American public is very supportive of these wars in that sense. Look, the Afghan military and Afghan police are losing what, between 30 and 35 guys killed a day in combat. Americans don't care if Afghans get killed, but you have a handful of Americans get killed anywhere, and it now becomes a political issue that can be used by one party against the other. So this is a brilliant policy for those who are in favor of the constant war, or who want the endless war, or who see the value in that, particularly the corporations, right? But also, too, those who believe in this need for America to be out there defending its borderlands, as I think, you know, a way to look at this in terms of historically, to be fighting the barbarians who are at our gates to defend our republic or our empire overseas. This is a great way to do it, because the only people getting killed are these brown-skinned Muslim folks, or maybe they're a darker shade if they're in Africa. But like that, and so it doesn't affect the American public, and the American public goes along with it, just as the beauty of getting away from conscription and the draft was for the American military to take the involvement of the American public out of our
war. And it really did revolutionize the nature of war fighting and military service. It's such a great point. And
yeah, and not only that too, it starts in the Clinton administration, but the outsourcing and the utilizing of private contractors, you know, under the Clinton administration, you first really see this in the Balkans, where we outsource a lot of our logistics efforts to private contractors. The LOGCAP program was what it called, for logistic capabilities. And you now get to the point where in Afghanistan, according to the Congressional Research Service, for every soldier we have in Afghanistan, we have 2.5 contractors. I mean, so you have, so you're, not only that, you're able, so now you're able to minimize the American soldier footprint and the American soldier deaths, of course, because that's hidden. We have no idea how many contractors were killed working for the American military, doing roles that in previous wars, in Vietnam or Korea or World War II, would have been done by American soldiers. You know, I saw this in Iraq. You know, you'd be on the main supply routes, and you'd see the burned out hulks of the logistic vehicles that we were using, the huge semi trucks, the big tractor trailers, the you know, in Afghanistan, the jingle trucks, you know, as we call them.